Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, I'm going to talk about the court's decision in Artis v. District of Columbia, which was issued on Monday, January 22nd, 2018. And this case, it was a 5-4 decision. It's our first 5-4 decision of the term. The majority opinion was written by Justice Ginsburg, and it was joined by which is generally considered the liberal wing of the court, with Chief Justice Roberts serving as the fifth, the swing vote in this case, and the other four more conservative members of the court making up the four-justice dissent in this case. And this is a case about statutes of limitation. It's a procedural case, It's not exactly not a high profile case, not the kind of thing you're going to hear a lot about, but it's interesting just to see the different ways that the justices try to reason through a question about the meaning of a particular statute. So the basic underlying case here was about a DC health inspector, a District of Columbia health inspector, who was fired. Now she sued under federal and state law, alleging gender discrimination and retaliation for reporting about gender discrimination. This underlying issue is not really relevant to the Supreme Court case. The issue at the Supreme Court is just a purely procedural thing. But the issue here comes out of something known as supplemental jurisdiction. Now, normally when you have a legal claim under state law, you can't automatically bring that in federal court. Now, there are some exceptions. Sometimes you can. There's something called diversity jurisdiction when suits are between people in different states, but that's not relevant here. Normally, a state law claim can't just be brought in federal court. However, when there are both federal and state claims that are part of the same case or controversy, that means there's a common core of facts that are the same for both types of claims, then the state claims can basically tag along in federal court with the federal claims. So if you have, in this case, a federal gender discrimination claim, and you have state law claims that come out of that same instance of discrimination, then you can bring those state law claims along with the federal claims in federal court. However, if the federal claims are later dismissed, if the federal court dismisses the federal claims, tosses them out, says that there's no viable claim there, then what happens to the state claims? Well, the court has discretion. They can keep them, but they can also dismiss the state claims. Basically, they decline to retain jurisdiction over the state claims and toss those out also. And that's pretty common. When all the federal claims are gone, the court will also get rid of the state claims as well. And in this case, that's what happened. There was a federal Title VII claim, a discrimination claim, and that was dismissed, and the court declined to also keep the supplemental state claims. Now, the issue here is that that can create a problem under the statute of limitation. So statute of limitation is a time limit on bringing a legal claim. And statutes of limitation, they vary depending on the type of action and what state or jurisdiction you're in. But there's typically some time frame, and after whatever the occurrence, the issue that's being sued about, after that happens, you have a certain amount of time to bring your action. If you wait beyond the statute of limitations, your claim is barred and you can't get into court. So what happens if you bring state law claims attached to federal claims as supplemental claims in federal court? The federal court later dismisses the federal claims and declines to keep the state law claims. Well, what happens if the statute of limitations on your state law claims ran out while your case was pending in federal court? You could be out of luck because you'd like to, as the plaintiff, you'd like to refile those state law claims in your state court. And, but if the statute of limitation has run out, then you've lost that opportunity. And through no fault of your own, just because the federal claim didn't stay alive, you've lost your state law claims also. So, the federal law takes account of that and has what's referred to as a tolling provision, and the specific terminology about tolling is the key dispute in this case. So I'm going to be coming back to that pretty heavily in a moment. But what this provision is let me I'll read you this is the provision as slightly modified in the court's opinion, just to kind of clarify it. It reads like this: the period of limitations for any state claim joined with a claim within federal court competence shall be told while the claim is pending in federal court and for a period of 30 days after it is dismissed, unless state law provides for a longer tolling period. So the basic idea is that they're saying the claim, the state law claim, the limitations period for the state law claim will be tolled. Now that's the key term. Now, so while the claim is pending and for 30 days after, so while the claim is in federal court and then for an extra 30 days, it says that the claim will be tolled. So what does it mean for a claim to be tolled? Now, the usual meaning when you're talking about statutes of limitations and someone says a statute of limitations is tolled is that the statute of limitations is suspended, or in other words, paused. Basically, the clock stops. So if a statute of limitations is running and then something happens that causes the clock that causes it to be tolled, the clock stops, and then after the tolling ends, the clock starts running again, and the rest of the time remains there. So in this situation, if we take that interpretation, suppose someone had a 3-year statute of limitations. They had sued after about a year and had 2 years left on their statute of limitations when they sued in federal court. Then when the case gets dismissed out of federal court, they still have the 2 years left over because the clock stopped when they filed their suit. They have those 2 years left over. The clock starts running again 30 days after it's dismissed, and then they have those leftover 2 years on their time. So that would be, if you interpreted the word tolled as suspended. And again, that is the typical meaning. That's the meaning that if you asked a typical litigator who had dealt with statute of limitations issues, what tolling means, or what it means to toll a statute of limitations or toll a period of limitations, that's the normal meaning. However, there's an alternate meaning that's being proposed in this case, which is the tolling can sometimes mean to remove the effect of something. So by tolling the period of limitations, it's basically just stopping that limitations to become a bar for a future action. So it's essentially kind of just like holding open the limitations period without actually stopping the clock. Under this view, the limitations period could still expire. The clock would still run while the case was pending in federal court. But then the limitations period would basically just be kind of held open once the case was dismissed for an extra 30 days, to give time for refiling. So these are the two interpretations of tolling, and the majority in the dissent take different sides on this in a moment. Now, it mattered here because in this case, when the plaintiff, when the federal claims were, when the federal case was dismissed, it was 59 days later that the plaintiff filed their claims in state court. Now, they had, when the federal action was filed, they had almost 2 years left on the state statute of limitations, but the federal claims, or the federal case was pending in federal court for about 3 years. So if the clock kept running during that time, and all the plaintiff got when it was dismissed was 30 days to refile in state court, then by filing 59 days later, the plaintiff missed the window. However, if you take the stopped clock interpretation, then once the federal case was thrown out, the plaintiff still had almost 2 years to refile. So it makes a big difference which of these two interpretations is correct. So I'll start with the majority opinion by Justice Ginsburg. So Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority. Again, she was joined by Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Chief Justice Roberts. And she notes in her opinion that there's two general approaches that are taken to limitations periods when there's an action pending in one court, and the legal system wants to give plaintiffs an opportunity to refile in a different court if it turns out that the case was in the wrong court or just somehow is not, if there's a better court that it should be filed in. One approach is the tolling approach, in other words, suspending or stopping the clock. But a second approach is providing a grace period. So just holding open after a case is dismissed in one court, basically giving some grace period, some period of time, 30 days, 60 days, some other period of time, in order to refile in a more appropriate court. And she notes that in different statutes and in different jurisdictions, both of these approaches are used. Sometimes tolling is used, sometimes grace periods are used. And what she points to is the specific language of the statute. It says that the period of limitation shall be tolled. And notes that in federal law, there are no examples. While there are federal laws that provide for grace periods for refiling in certain circumstances, there are no examples of federal statute that involves a grace period approach that uses the word tolling, that says that it's tolling the limitations period. Justice Ginsburg also points to Black's Law Dictionary. That's kind of the preeminent authority on the meaning of legal language. And it defines tolling with the meaning of suspending a clock, suspending a time period. She goes on to discuss case law, the various precedents discussing statute of limitation and tolling, and notes that the words tolling and suspending are just used interchangeably, routinely. She notes one single case that refers to a grace period as tolling and suspending a limitations period, even though it's a grace period and not an actual stopping of a clock. But what she says about that is, quote, "This atypical use of tolling or suspending to mean something other than stopping the clock on a limitations period is a feather on the scale against the weight of decisions in which tolling a statute of limitations signals stopping the clock." So she's basically saying that one case is an outlier, and generally whenever you say you're tolling a limitations period, that means you're stopping the clock. She also notes some anomalies in taking the other approach. She says that if you're just talking about a grace period, then why do you say you're tolling it while the case is pending? Why not just say you're tolling it for 30 days after the dismissal? And it's even possible, she argues, under the other interpretation that you could interpret the other position, that this is a grace period position, under that language to allow a claim that had already expired before the federal case was filed to kind of be revived by the dismissal of the federal case. She argues that grace period reading would allow claims to kind of spring back to life if you took that interpretation. She also notes that having tolling plus adding a brief addition of time is not unknown in federal statutes. It's a common approach. And then there's another issue, a separate issue that was raised that she addresses, and this is the issue of whether for Congress to have enacted this tolling provision as an actual stop clock tolling provision would raise constitutional concerns as exceeding Congress's authority. And the reason is that this is telling states, what claims they are required to allow into their courts. It's telling states, well, regardless of whether your statute of limitations would have barred this claim, under this federal statute, we're requiring you to keep these claims alive and allow them in. So that's a federal encroachment on state authority. And so there's an argument that this might exceed Congress's authority as not necessary and proper to federal powers. And Justice Ginsburg addresses that, and she cites, basically relies on a 2003 case called Cheeks v. Richland County, and says that case basically resolves this issue. And that case had decided that having this kind of a tolling provision, or having a provision that keeps state claims alive, serves the purposes of the federal judiciary. It basically creates a viable forum for plaintiffs that have both state and federal claims, and allows them to bring those claims all in one court without worrying that they're going to lose some of their claims and have them be dismissed, just if there happens to be no federal issue in play. And moreover, she says, even if you assume that using a grace period instead of a stopped clock approach would be less intrusive on the states, stopped clock approach is still a standard method of providing more time and statutes of limitations, and Congress isn't required to adopt the least intrusive option as long as they have a proper federal purpose. So that's kind of a quick summary of the majority's approach. So Justice Gorsuch writes the dissent, and he takes the opposite view and says that this statute is really supposed to just be providing a grace period, just the 30-day grace period. He points to some other dictionaries. These are not necessarily not legal dictionaries, but general dictionaries, which define a meaning of toll as including to take away or bar or defeat or annul something. And argues that in this case it means to do that, to take away the effect of a limitations period's termination. He also points to a 1983 Supreme Court case that uses the term tolling kind of broadly to encompass both a stopped clock approach and grace period approaches. And then he goes on to a kind of a deep historical dive and talks about the origins of tolling and discusses the two different types. And in his kind of recounting of the history, the stopped clock approach of tolling is the typical approach used by courts and developed at common law to protect a plaintiff when there was some disability or condition that prevented them from filing their action. So one example might be when defendant has committed some sort of fraud that prevents a plaintiff from learning that they've been wronged, then that can toll the statute of limitations until that fraud is uncovered. That's sometimes called a discovery rule. But another might be certain forms of disability, where if a person is injured and rendered unconscious from that injury, they're in a coma or something like that, the statute of limitations might be tolled until they regain consciousness and are able to move forward with a lawsuit. But on the other hand, in Justice Gorsuch's historical recounting, grace periods were the typical approach used when a case was filed in the wrong court, when a case is in some court or form of adjudication and belongs somewhere else, then a grace period is the normal way that that's dealt with. And he also says that basically that's the standard practice. It's pretty much universal in states that when they have these type of refiling allowances to let people refile and not be barred by a statute of limitation, the states pretty universally provide some sort of grace period, grace periods of various different lengths, but a grace period rather than stop clock tolling. And he goes on to say that the approach that the majority advocates using stop clock approach is he has a few arguments. That one is that it just isn't a good fit for the circumstance. Under the majority's approach, looking at, for example, the facts of this case, the plaintiff in this case is getting two full years, almost 2 years that they had left on their statute of limitations. So those extra 30 days that are added on in the statute are kind of irrelevant in most cases when the plaintiff gets to keep a large chunk of the statute of limitations. And the only time when that 30 days really makes any difference is when they filed their case right before the statute of limitations was going to expire. And in those cases, the 30 days is basically the same effect as having a grace period anyway. So, it seems that a grace period would have been a better fit to the problem that the court was trying to solve. He also points to the one aspect of the statute, the part where it says that it says the tolling period, the state law claims will be, the period of limitation will be tolled while the case is pending and for 30 days afterward, unless the state law would provide a longer tolling period. He notes that this is a very, when you think about what this actually means, it's very odd phrasing, because the tolling period is not the 30 days. The tolling period is the entire time that the case is pending in federal court plus the 30 days. That's the time that, according to the statute, that it shall be tolled. And so that's a bizarre period of time to be comparing to the state, what the states, the extra time that the state would provide, because it seems to suggest that whether or not the plaintiff gets the benefit of this extra federal, the federal tolling period or the states depends on how long the case has been pending in federal court, which isn't intuitive. It seems clear that, what was intended here is they're saying 30 days or the state period, whichever is longer. So if a state provides a grace period that's longer than 30 days, they get the state grace period. But that's not actually what the language means if you interpret tolling to mean the stop clock and the tolling period to include the entire time it was pending plus the 30 days. So he says that that's an absurd result that Congress couldn't have intended. And he also makes a few other arguments. He says that when you're construing the meaning of a federal statute, you should be construing it in light of the common law rules that those statutes were supplanting, and that this is an area that there were common law rules developed on state courts over many, many years and over the centuries, and that you should interpret it to be kind of consistent with the rules that were in place before. And he also raises the constitutional concern, the one that Justice Ginsburg dismissed in her majority opinion, saying basically that all of the federal purposes here would be equally served by the grace period. And just because a stop clock tolling, because that's common in some circumstances, doesn't mean it's proper in any circumstance, and that because it's unnecessary to fulfill Congress's purposes, it's not a proper exercise of federal power. So that's the basic shape of Justice Gorsuch's dissent here. So I want to step back a little and talk about a couple kind of bigger picture issues related to this case. First of all, it's clear, regardless of which interpretation you adopt here, the majorities or the dissents, the statute is poorly drafted. Under the majority's stop clock reading, the reference to the tolling period and whether the tolling period is longer than or whether the state provides a longer tolling period, it's nonsensical. It's clearly not what anyone would have intended when they were writing that, to refer to the entire time that the case is pending in federal court. But on the other hand, if you take the dissent's reading, the Justice Gorsuch's approach, then the statute is using the phrase "told" in an incredibly counterintuitive sense, saying that the limitations period is told when basically any lawyer who's dealt with statute of limitations would understand that to mean it's paused or suspended, and using it to have a totally different meaning that is not not apparent for that language. And this kind of sloppy drafting or loose language, it's not unusual, especially in the statute of limitations area where we're dealing sometimes with not fully intuitive approaches to counting and dealing with time. And I'll give one example that I've encountered in my own career. And it's when you're dealing with criminal statutes of limitations, they are typically phrased in a forward-looking way. They say that basically when an offense is committed, then essentially the clock starts, and there's, say, for example, 5 years from the time the offense is committed for the person to be indicted. So it must be brought within 5 years. And then so the limitations period is counting forward from the time the offense is committed. And when that period, say 5 years, runs out, then the prosecution is barred for that particular offense. But if you look at legal briefs and judicial opinions talking about statute of limitations, they're often phrased in a backward-looking language, where they will talk about the indictment or when a particular defendant was indicted, and look backward from that and refer to whether the offense occurred within the 5-year period reaching back from the indictment. So it's an opposite way. Now, you're going to get, if it's a simple, you're just looking at 5 years from the beginning or the end, you're going to get, it's the same end result, whether the offense and the indictment are within 5 years of each other. But when you start dealing with tolling or complicated questions of whether there was persistent activity occurring over time or repeated activity, then it can be very confusing when you're trying to reconcile the actual statutory language with court opinions that are describing it in a backward-looking different direction, and sometimes the language from the court opinions and the language in the statutes don't mesh well and give you some very confusing and counterintuitive interpretations that weren't intended by the judges issuing those decisions. So it's not surprising that, you know, the drafters of the statute might have had one thing in mind and used words in slightly inconsistent ways or phrased things in ways that didn't actually necessarily fully capture exactly what they were trying to say. Returning to the specific case, during his confirmation hearings, Justice Gorsuch and also his supporters, they emphasized his adherence to a theory of statutory interpretation known as textualism. And this is an approach to interpreting statutes that says that basically that judges should be bound by the meaning of the words in the enacted text rather than looking beyond the text at things like the subjective intentions of the drafters of the statute or the broad purposes the law was supposed to serve and whether one interpretation or another better serves those broad purposes. Instead they should focus on the words of the statute in their context and the meaning of those words themselves. And this is an approach that was championed by Justice Scalia. He was probably the most prominent advocate of this type of approach. And over the past few decades, it's become the dominant approach on the Supreme Court across the ideological spectrum. And for example, Justice Kagan, who's appointed by President Obama to the court, is a proponent of textualism and often uses textualist language in her opinions. And even when the justices are divided on an issue of statutory interpretation, both sides will typically try to anchor their reading in the text itself. And we see that here in both the Ginsburg and the Gorsuch opinion. They both argue that the text of the statute should dictate their results because, you know, they're discerning, you know, in context how the language, what the language should mean and finding inconsistencies or absurdities or whatever in a different interpretation of that language. So, with that in mind, I want to step back and just editorialize just a little bit about this case. Now, on one hand, the grace period approach that Justice Gorsuch is pushing for in his opinion, it has a lot going for it. It seems to make a lot more sense as a policy matter in this case. It's the normal way of accomplishing this kind of thing. It's the routinely used in state law for this type of for allowing for refiling. And the lengthy extension of a limitations period that a stop clock approach provides is kind of unnecessary in this type of situation. A law may have a statute of limitations of 2, 3, 6 years, even longer for someone to file a claim. And there may be good reason for that. When someone is injured and deciding if they're going to file a claim, they have to first, they have to decide if this is something worth suing over. They have to find a lawyer. They may have to conduct legal research. The lawyer may have to do due diligence in interviewing or gathering other evidence to flesh out their complaint. There's a lot of decisions and process involved. And so it makes sense, especially when people may be dealing with other issues related to if there's a serious harm or injury, there may be just other, medical or financial concerns that they're dealing with. So it makes sense to give people a sufficiently long period of time that they're able to accomplish those tasks and get their claim filed before it's barred. But on the other hand, when you've already filed your claim in federal court and now it's just a matter of refiling the claims in state court, at that point, it's largely a matter of cutting and pasting allegations into a new form and just adjusting it for the specific requirements of the state as opposed to the federal court. It's something that, a 30-day grace period can adequately cover. So there's a lot of sense to saying that a grace period makes sense in this case. And Justice Gorsuch also makes a strong case that the drafters of this provision in the federal law probably intended to apply a grace period, and there's a lot of indications that this is what a lot of people thought this law was doing, that they thought that this was a grace period because of the 30-day language. But on the other hand, although he shows that sometimes phrases like tolling provision or tolling period are sometimes used broadly to refer to grace periods also, he does not provide any examples of a statute that uses very similar language, saying a period of limitations will be told, and actually means a grace period rather than stopping the clock. And that's kind of a strong advantage that Justice Ginsburg's majority has. So that brings me back around to textualism. And textualism, the proponents of this approach, they argue that there's a lot of various virtues to textualism, that it constrains judges in certain ways and reduces certain costs of determining what the law actually is. But there is one inescapable issue with textualism, which is that sometimes what the legislators intend to do or think they're doing is not what the text they enact actually says. There are mistakes or just lapses or just a failure of imagination to think through all the circumstances. And a serious textualist needs to be willing to sometimes to swallow the bitter pill and say, well, even though the legislators thought they were solving a problem in a particular way, they actually did something different. The language they enacted actually doesn't fully solve the problem they thought they were solving, doesn't fully address the issue that they thought they were addressing. But here it just seems that Gorsuch doesn't really seem to be willing to swallow that pill. And he makes a good argument that's what they were trying to do. But I wonder whether he really crosses the finish line in convincing that that's what they actually did. That's what that language can fairly mean when it uses language that pretty much universally refers to a stopped clock approach. So that's it for this episode. Please subscribe to Counting to Five on YouTube or your audio podcast app of choice. For timely coverage of the latest developments of the court, please check out Counting to Five's weekly YouTube live streams, where you can ask your own questions in the live chat. We're currently broadcasting Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, but check the Counting to Five YouTube channel for the next scheduled live stream. I'm always looking for your feedback. Please leave a comment or send me an email at mike@countingtofive.com. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.